Congratulations, boy.
Many gave their lives that we might stand here once again, united in the government of a lawful republic.
Gaius Octavian was henceforth to be regarded, for all intents and purposes, as my lawful son.
Gaius Octavian.
All right, on 3, 2, 1, welcome back, Raimondo, to the life of Augustus.
How's it going?
Good, you sound different. Why do you sound different, Ray?
Oh, sorry, I don't know. I didn't touch anything. My hands are, you said you told me to put my hands on the desk this time. That's where they're at. I have no idea.
Well, yeah, you're using a different mic today. I just sort of let people know why you sound different. You're using a different mic.
Yes, yes.
You survived the snowpocalypse of January 2016?
Yeah, I got a couple days off from work. Spent a little bit too much time with the family. Snow's still all over the place, but things are slowly getting back to normal. I survived except for my left buttock, which you may have seen on Facebook. I have survived.
So tell everyone else the story of your left buttock.
So we live on a hill, a small mountain, and my girls were sledding and said, Dad, you gotta do this. It's awesome. You know, I don't like to be cold. I don't like to be inconvenienced. I don't really like to be bothered. So I told them I would go down the hill one time, and other than that, leave me alone. So I get on the sled, and I'm slightly heavier than my daughters. So I make a deeper impression in the snow. And the path they were going over, there was a tree trunk, and I went over the same path, forgetting that it was there, which 7 feet into the ride, caught my left buttock, tore my pants, tore the sled. I go rolling off screaming in pain. I can't even move for about 10 seconds. I'm in so much pain. I look up and Heather's laughing her ass off. I'm trying to cuss her out. I'm literally trying to cuss her out. I'm leaving you. I'm divorcing you. I've got somebody in Texas, but I couldn't get out. The pain was too damn much. So I literally lay there for a while. She's like, "Oh, it's been 5 minutes, and he's still lying down." So she comes down, and the pants are ruined, the sled's ruined, my pride is ruined, and the left buttock. It's still. I'm sitting, leaning slightly to the right. So just be careful, people. Just be careful out there.
Oh, dear me. Oh, funny.
That was my last sled ride ever.
That reminds me of when my the day before Chrissy and I went to the US in 2011 to get married.
Mm-hmm.
My sons, who were probably 11 at the time, said, "Hey, Dad, do you want to ride on one of our scooters down the hill?"
Hell yeah.
I was like, hell yeah, scooter, Dad.
I still got it. Awesome. Yeah.
And it's quite a steep hill, our driveway, block of townhouses. Hurtling down there, car pulls out in front of me. I don't know how to brake the thing, so I put my foot out in front of me, fly through the air, stick my hands out to brake my fall on the bitumen, and take all the skin off both palms of my hands, plus tear the bursa in my left shoulder. So, I wrap it all up. And then I fly 24 hours to the US with hair looking like I'm the mummy from the Orient Express. Bleeding everywhere, like scabs on the palms of my hands while I'm in the US for a couple of weeks. Meeting all Chrissy's family for the first time. And wrapped up like the mummies. Yeah, good times.
You do
good
make
times.
A good first impression.
I know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, video. So while we're in Vegas recently, we shot a couple of videos. The first one, 70 minutes long.
Yeah.
Ray, myself, and Sir J. David Markham, in front of a live audience, talking about Napoleon, Alexander, and Caesar. Comparing them, comparing their strengths and their weaknesses, talking about their legacies, now available for a measly sum of $9.
Right.
Lifeofcaesar.com/Vegas. If you would like to spend an hour and 10 minutes rubbing one out to...
I did.
It was 2 minutes, but then the other hour at 8, you were recovering. Lifeofcaesar.com/Vegas. Check that out. There's a second hour and something of just Ray and I talking about empires.
That's right.
Is America an empire? We might put that up in the next month, depending on whether or not people like this one. If people want,
let us know.
Yeah, if people like the videos, great. If you don't like it, I'll save my fucking effort and won't go to all the trouble of editing it and uploading it and all that shit.
Not bitter at all.
No, not at all.
No. Check it out. It was a lot of fun. It was really a lot of fun talking to Jay David. I'm pretty sure he knew my name by the end of the conversation. Maybe. I don't know. You tell me.
No, I don't think so. No. Don't think he even noticed you were there.
He agreed with me once, and I got a laugh from the guys behind the camera once. So I'm golden. I'm good.
At the end of episode 12, Ray.
Yeah. Yeah.
What happened? Well, prescriptions, basically.
Yes. A lot of financial rape. Betrayal and just literally, you know, just turning society upside down on its head.
I think we talked a lot about the economics of the prescriptions, what they were raising money for, but also how they were literally wiping out one class of wealthy Roman elite and creating a brand new class of wealthy Roman elite.
Yeah, the ones that were loyal to them, yeah.
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 And then on the 1st of January, 42 BCE, the new consuls were sworn in. Lepidus, this is his second consulship, even though it's only been 4 years since his last.
Go Lepidus.
No rules. No one cares. We do no whatever laws. We want.
That's right. Do whatever. But don't worry, folks. Lepidus is on his way down.
And Lucius Munatius Plancus. Now, obviously famous for two things. One, he was one of the commanders who had joined Antony after Mutina. We talked about him. He was kind of the guy that really had Antony's back and enabled Antony to recover after Mutina. Also, he invented planking. That's what we remember him for. If you look him up in Wikipedia,
there's a picture of him lying
flat.
And, like nobody else can.
The Romans were like, that is fucking awesome. Look at that dude. He's just lying straight.
He's like a board, like a plank, if you will.
How did planking ever become a thing? Seriously.
I can't do it right now because, you know, I'm recording, so my pants are off. I'll do it later.
How did it become a thing, really? Like for like 6 months, that was a thing.
Yeah.
Fucking the internet, man.
Exactly.
It was probably while, you know, the American elite were just taking another $1 trillion out of the U.S. Treasury in cash, and they were like, we need to distract the people for 6 months. I don't know. Somebody just lie down and we'll take a photo and tell them it's a thing.
Literally a photo of someone lying down. Mm. Yeah.
So anyway, they're replacing Octavian and the guy who was like his cousin who died.
Right, oops.
From trying to tell people, don't worry about the prescriptions. It's not going to be that bad. Here's the interesting thing. So the new consuls were sworn in, and they took an oath. The new consuls, along with Antony and Octavian, and the rest of the Senate, that all of the deeds of Gaius Julius Caesar were to be forever binding.
Damn. On a scale from 1 to 10, I imagine the consuls are doing their thing. Yay. Then there's Mark Antony and Caesar. Yay. And then there's the Senate going, if you got a sword to my throat, I will go ahead and take this oath. I have no problem with that. But you know that they're not happy. They're being told what to do, just like when Caesar was around. Nothing has changed for the Senate. In fact, it's probably worse for them.
Yeah, well.
The ones who are still alive.
Yeah, I wonder how many of them are still alive. Out of the 800 or 900 members of the Senate that we had around Caesar's time, you have to wonder how many survived the prescriptions.
Yeah, the book, Goldsworthy made a good point. He was like, if you were someone who had, if your family for generations had been in the Senate and your name is, you know, maybe they're going to take something from you, you've got avenues to, you've got other people to talk for you in your defense. If you're a nouveau, if you're one of the new guys and you don't have those generations of support, you know, you had no chance of surviving, but some of the other blue bloods, if you will, were able to get through it. But again, it all comes back to name, the bloodline, you know, that kind of stuff. But yeah, a lot of the middle class and I guess upper middle class got the axe, and a lot of the elites were able to get through there as long as they hadn't pissed off the triumvirate.
Or if you had a hot daughter, you could get to sleep with Mark Antony.
That works. Whatever works.
Yeah. You would have been all right. You would have survived.
I would have survived. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Just get down on your knees and zip his. Now, they also, so we'd already seen them accept, the Senate already accepted all of Caesar's acts, not, you know, just after the assassination.
Right.
But obviously there's been a bit of a flip-flopping going on, depending on who's running the you know the show in Rome,
right
in the next couple of years. So now they've taken an oath for once and for all, forever binding, no flip-flopping anymore on Caesar's deeds. And of course, you know, a lot of this has to go with his land distribution plans to the retiring soldiers. And you know, Antony, Octavian, and Lepidus need to keep those guys happy.
Yeah, there for these next two episodes that we're going to record tonight. I mean, the subtitle should be self-centeredness and greed. I mean, these guys have to keep the soldiers happy because the soldiers are going to keep them in power, and the soldiers are going to get a sense of their power and make demands on these guys, which would never have flown with the original JC. And but they truly know that they have to appease these guys and keep them happy because you're the ones who grouped all these men together. You gave them swords, and now they have their own power, you know, their own power. And the soldiers aren't stupid. They're going to figure this out and make certain demands.
Mm. Now, as well as taking an oath about the deeds of Caesar, they also formally consecrated him as a god, and they begin working on a temple to Julius Caesar near the site where he was cremated, and that temple, or the remains of it anyway, still stand to this very day. You can go, in fact, you know, if you come with us on our Caesar tour.
Yeah.
When are we doing the Caesar tour? Maybe, what, next year?
I don't know, but I do want to say that the next CamRayCon of 2017, we were talking about New Orleans, maybe New Orleans.
Oh, love New Orleans. I thought we were talking about doing it in Brisbane.
That too. Heather is totally up in the air. She can't decide Brisbane, New Orleans, so whatever you want her to do. This is going to come out wrong. Whatever you want my wife to do, she'd probably do.
Oh, I know.
Where were y'all when I was sick for 2 days? I was nervous.
Yeah, I'm working on the three generations: your mother-in-law, Heather, and your eldest daughter.
My oldest daughter.
Yeah.
Well, good for you.
Yeah. So they're building this temple. They've officially consecrated him as a god. This means that Octavian is now officially the son of a god. And I wonder how that, you know, it's J. David Markham goes to extreme lengths to make sure that we all remember that he is now a knight of the Order of the French Palm.
Right.
And that we should refer to him as Sir. I mean, that came up every four minutes during the conversations. I wonder what Octavian was like at this stage. I mean, and how do you refer to him now that he's officially the son of a god, just in everyday conversation? Yeah. So, you know, Antony and Lepidus and Octavian, the triumvirate, are sitting around, and Antony goes, "Hey, Octavian," he goes, "that's Lord. Lord God Octavian to you." Well, I guess they were calling him Caesar. He wanted to be called Caesar. "Hey, Caesar," that would be you know, your mightiness, Lord God Caesar, to you. Right. Thank you.
Well, the minimum you had to call him Caesar at this point. But see, and this is the part, and again, I don't want to do to Augustus kind of what I feel like sometimes we've done to Alexander. I just want to stop for a moment. This kid is not yet 21. He's one of the triumvirs. He is now the son of a god, and he wisely, either Team Caesar tells him this or he figures it out on his own, not to really push that too much. Okay, yes, you've got this title, but don't go around, you know, expecting or demanding people call you the son of a god. So he very wisely just says, yeah, I'll take that. I'll put it in here. I'll save it for later. But right now, I certainly do insist on being called Julius Caesar because that is now my legal name.
And of course, he said, "Well, I'm just a god. I'm not the god. Just
not yet.
A god. Yeah.
Yeah.
Son of a god, Divus Filius. Yeah. So that's kind of.
He's 20 years old. I would have gone crazy. I would have been. Yeah, you're getting banged by the son of a god right now. That's what I would have been doing. Just I don't know. But he wisely pulls back.
I wonder if he had stickers made up that he could hand out to the women. I've been banged by the son of God.
Hey, would you like to see a little piece of heaven? No, but you know, but he wisely holds back from that because he's got so far to go to prove himself, especially when he's standing next to Marcus Antonius.
Do you think he and Jesus had like a club? It was like the son of a God.
The world's smallest club. Yeah.
The son of a god club. You got to be a son of a god. You got to be officially a son of a god to get in. Right. Show your credentials.
Right.
Yeah. Sit around going, shit, you think your dad's tough to live up to? Man.
Check this out. Yeah. Because Alexander was only, what, I don't know about divine, but he was like, you know, godly or godlike, but he was still a human. He was just, I guess, divine, but he certainly wasn't on their level as far as the trappings of a religious whatever.
And which one do you think is worse? Do you think it's worse to be son of a god for like when your god has always been a god? Or is it worse to be the son of a new god? Caesar's just become a god and he's like, you know, like, he's just like, I'm the son of a god, but he's a new god, man. Like he's just, is it like being nouveau riche and, you know, all of a sudden you have to start go overboard wearing the trappings of gods?
Right.
You know, going around banging human women, you know.
I don't know. I mean, as much as the Julius Caesar did for everybody, he's gone. And you can have fond memories, but he can't do anything for you anymore. He's gone. He's no longer of this world. And you just kind of think that little JC is just waiting to prove himself. He's got to prove himself. No one's going to give him anything. He's got to earn it. He's got to prove it. And he's going to get his opportunity, but it's going to be a slow process for him. I think he's got the worst situation, to answer your question.
So late in 43 BCE, just before the new consuls were sworn in, Artia, Octavian's mother, died.
Yeah.
She lived long enough to see her son gain the consulship and become one of the triumvirs.
That's something.
Well, yeah, particularly when they were trying to talk him out of it.
Right.
So kind of crazy for her. She then received a public funeral, which was something usually reserved for the consuls.
Right, yeah, but especially not for a woman. Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a big deal.
So why do you think they would give a public funeral for Artia?
Well, I mean, she is the mother of one of the three who are ruling Rome, and they don't have to run anything by the Senate. They don't have to get votes. If your two mates are on board with it, you can pretty much do anything you want. So I think he, just like every other Roman boy, worshipped his mother. I mean, you know, you idolize your father, but you worship your mother. And he had the ability to send her off in this amazing way, and there was no way he was going to not do that.
But it was not something that had been done before.
Right, so, which makes it even more special.
Right. He loves his mama.
Yeah.
Now, Octavian was now engaged to the daughter of an elderly aristocrat, But yeah. this had been broken off when the triumvirate was formed. He was like,
I'm sorry.
But, you know, they were obviously, you know, I think as the triumvirate, they were looking for some sort of political marriage to stabilize the alliance, as we've talked about many times before, with Caesar and Pompey trying to marry each other's daughters, and obviously going back to Philip and Alexander doing political marriages. But neither Lepidus nor Antony had a daughter of suitable age for him to marry, so he married Fulvia's daughter from her first marriage to Clodius.
Yeah. Now, again, we have to stress this because it's so easy to bypass this, but the army was absolutely insisting upon some formal arrangement, some kind of, you know, you can't just tell us that you're best mates and you're never going to fight each other, because us soldiers are sick and tired of killing each other, of fighting for each other. We're not fighting foreigners, we're fighting each other, and it's a lot harder to fight a Roman army, and a lot of us are dying. We're sick and tired of it. This is all for your glory. We want some kind of cementing of a deal, so someone is going to get married. We don't give a fuck who, but there better be a marriage pretty soon somewhere with you three guys. And they demanded that, and the triumvirate knew they had to acquiesce to this.
So Fulvia is now Antony's wife, and Octavian's going to marry her daughter from her marriage to Clodius.
Yes.
For those that are new to the series and haven't listened to the old series, Clodius was he was pushing for a lot of reform.
Right.
The cause of a lot of bloodshed between him and Milo, his main enemy in Rome at the time. Clodius also was sort of under the wing of Pompey and Caesar and Crassus. Mm-hmm. Ends up getting killed in a fight in the middle of Rome. His supporters go batshit crazy and burn down the Senate.
They literally burn down the Senate. As far as I know, has not been fixed yet.
Well, Caesar was going to build a new one, but then they killed Caesar too. But they sort of built a funeral pyre for Clodius out of the Senate. Anyway, his daughter's name was Claudia. She was still a couple of years younger than the normal marrying age. And Octavian said, look, if there's grass on the pitch, you can play ball. Octavian, no, down boy, down. So they were married, but they didn't live together.
Right.
Sort of what we know as the Woody Allen. They did a Woody Allen, and they got divorced 2 years later, and Octavian claimed that she was still a virgin.
Yes, yes. He made an official declaration that she was still pure, that he had not done what was the right of a husband. And I think that's another smart move on his part, because Rome is, you know, for all of its weirdness or whatever, a pretty conservative place, and that would have not gone over well.
But you've got to wonder about the point of a political marriage when they don't live together and they don't fuck and they don't have any offspring.
Right.
I mean, what is the point of that political marriage apart from it looking good in the newspaper? It's not really serving the purpose of the political marriage, which is to tie the loyalty of the families together by having offspring that everyone cares about, and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I can't kill you because my son and your daughter and their man, they have a child. So you're right. So it doesn't serve the purpose it should have, but again, the army was insisting upon it, and so they did the best they could with what they had.
And she wasn't even Antony's daughter; she was his
stepdaughter. It was the best they could do. Yeah,
it was the best they could do. Yeah,
yeah.
So it provided a political bond between Antony and Octavian for a while. Only a few months ago, they were trading insults and trying to kill each other.
Some pretty good insults. Yeah. Yeah.
Now they are going to share command of a massive army and go east to fight against Brutus and Cassius. Poor Lepidus has to stick around in Italy with only a few legions.
Well, see, this is my point. These guys do not trust each other. So it's like Mark Antony and Caesar are going to have this massive force, something larger than Caesar, ever had, but they're going to be away from Rome, the seat of power. Lepidus will be left in Rome, the seat of power, but he will only have a few legions in case the other two need to come back and kick his ass in case he tries something. So there's all these checks and balances. These gentlemen do not trust each other, and you can't really blame them. So they're literally being very careful with each other.
You know, I'm reading a book on the Cold War at the moment for reasons you can guess, but it kind of reminds me, the triumvirate, these guys, it kind of reminds me of the Grand Alliance. It reminds me of Churchill, Stalin, and Roosevelt or Truman sitting down and going, all right, listen, we don't like each other,
but let's
all work together on this thing because it's all in our best interest that we work together. Yeah. But I'm not really sure I trust you.
Well, we either work together or we kill each other. And who wants that?
Mm.
You know, nobody wants to die.
Yeah. So Paul Lepidus is going to get the rough end of the stick here. If you think about it, Antony and Octavian are going to go off and fight Brutus and Cassius. Now, one of two things, well, maybe one of three things is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
If they defeat Brutus and Cassius,
right,
Antony and Octavian are going to come back more powerful than ever.
Right. And one can stop them. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, the triumvirate exists because there's sort of a presumption of a fairly equal balance of power between the three, or, you know, you don't want two to gang up on the third. So they're trying to keep the balance there as much as possible to keep an eye on each other. But if they go off and defeat Brutus and Cassius, they're really going to come back and have no need for Lepidus. However, if they go off and they get defeated...
Lepidus is going to be alone. And all those guys are going to... Didn't you prescribe half of my family? Oh, you're fucking dead. Yeah. So he's like, he more than anybody really wants them to win this next battle.
Yeah. The third alternative is it could be a nobody wins, nobody loses situation, a stalemate. Maybe they all die and he's the last man standing. That would probably have been the best outcome for him.
Yeah.
But really, it's kind of a lose-lose situation for Lepidus. He must have drawn the short straw when they were working out how this was going to work.
Well, it makes sense. Caesar has to go because they killed his father. He's got to get revenge. That's what you do. You honor your father. I get that. Mark Antony, and again, we cannot stress this enough, Mark Antony does not have a ton of military experience, but he's damn sure got more than the new Julius Caesar. So it makes sense that he's got to go. But I wonder if Lepidus could have went instead of Mark Antony. I don't know how much experience he had.
Yeah, I think these are the two guys that have really got the biggest connection with their troops, and they've probably thrown the most money at it. Anyway, he's consul, so it's his turn to be consul. Kind of makes sense that he stays at home and runs things.
I just thought of something. What happened the last time Mark Antony was left alone in charge in Rome?
Yeah,
everything up. Caesar had to come back and.
Yeah.
Put so much to right. Yeah, so it makes sense that he's getting out of town.
Except for when he was consul after Caesar died, and then turned to shit as well.
Right. Don't put him in charge.
He's not very well liked, Antony. So Lepidus is going to stay at home, but it's not a good situation. Now, by now, Brutus and Cassius, we haven't really talked a lot about them, so we should talk a little bit about what they've been up to. At this stage, they have more than 20 legions, which, you know, somewhat over like 90,000 troops. This is a massive army.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about how many legions Caesar tended to have during the Gallic campaigns, even during the Civil War, very rarely did he get anywhere close to 90,000 troops.
Right. I think I remember when he was in Gaul, at one point, I think he got up, because we were pretty excited about this, I think he got up to like 10 or 11 legions, maybe, and I'm sure they were always, you know, not at full strength. If you just imagine Caesar with 90,000 troops, he could have been another Alexander. He could have taken over the world. He never had those kind of odds, which is probably, I don't know, best for the world. But yeah, these guys are going to come in and they're not going to have any idea how to control 90,000 men. No one does, because no one over here on the Roman side has ever had that many men under their command before.
Yeah. I was just thinking, even Alexander, when he gets into India, we've been talking about, he's got like...
Yeah, like 40,000, 50,000, you know, at his peak, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, as you pointed out, I mean, Caesar was a very experienced commander, Alexander was an experienced commander, and even they had to, struggle with how do you communicate orders in the middle of a battle to that many people. Brutus and Cassius really have very little experience commanding armies of any size. Yeah. And now they've got the largest army Rome has ever seen under their command. Yeah. Now, I've got a complaint to make about modern historians. All of the modern histories I've been reading refer to Brutus and Cassius as the liberators. Well, the liberators did this and the liberators did that. Fuck the liberators. I refuse to call them the liberators.
And we're going to prove in these next two episodes that they were just as self-serving as everyone else.
Let's just call them the assassins instead of the liberators.
The knife wielders, yeah, because that's what they were.
They may have referred to themselves as the liberators, but, you know.
Yeah.
I refuse. It's got a positive connotation, the name. I refuse to refer to them. I refuse to give them that much credit.
Right. If I could add on to something that we were talking about a second ago, not only do these guys have larger forces than in the history of Rome, but their men are not really loyal to them. You know, like some of the men for Caesar would have died for him. In fact, it did die for him. But these guys are they only have these troops because they're paying them and they're giving them bonuses. And don't get me wrong, they're not paying them. They're stealing from all the provinces. We'll get to that later. But these soldiers, and very few of them have any experience. Very few of them were with the original Julius Caesar. They don't give a shit about the cause. They don't give a shit about the generals. All they care about is the signature on the check that's coming to them. So Octavius's men don't care about Mark Antony, vice versa. Cassius's men do not care about Brutus and vice versa. There is absolutely no loyalty. Everyone is out to serve themselves, and it's the second the money stops, it would all fall apart. So there's no loyalty to your commander. Those days that we experienced with Julius Caesar and the amazing things his men did for him and that he did for them, those are gone.
They did it for him, and he could also call upon them to do it for Rome and do it for the fatherland and these sorts of things. Yeah. I mean, I think these
patriotism.
People... Yeah.
Yeah. Gone.
That's all gone. These guys, as you say, it's purely mercenary armies at this stage. They're doing it for a buck. They're doing it because they're being forced into it and threatened with what will happen to them if they don't do it, perhaps. Right. The same way that these eastern provinces are having to foot the bill for Brutus and Cassius's army. They're getting squeezed with heavy taxes. They're having to supply food and billet the soldiers. I mean, some might have been doing it willingly, but I'm sure most of them were being forced to at the point of a gladius.
And here's the other part, and I did not truly appreciate this until recently. If you're a king and you're in control of one of the Asian provinces, if you give the conspirators any trouble, they know that there are, you know, you have maybe a half brother or a cousin or whatever who wants a throne. They could replace you like that. They could kill you, put someone else in charge. So you better say yes, because someone else will, and they can just replace you. And so the people in the Asian provinces had no choice but to give them what they wanted or to suffer for it.
That's right. And just in case you think Brutus and Cassius are the nice guys in this equation.
No.
You want to talk about Rhodes?
Well, yeah, so when 43 BCE is going on and the prescriptions are going on in Rome, you know, Cassius and Brutus know that it's only a matter of time that the triumvirate is going to either come to them or they're going to have to go there. They can't just stay out in the Asian province forever. So and just sit there and live out the rest of their lives. So they are massing huge amounts of supplies, large troops, and they're getting everything together, getting all the ships they can. And so Cassius goes to Rhodes and he says, okay, you've got a treaty with Rome. We represent Rome because we're the liberators. And so we demand that you give us pretty much everything you possibly can. Now, Rhodes has been attacked. They've been invaded, but they're still standing and they're pretty proud of their history. So if I can read a little bit of Appian. So when Cassius goes to Rhodes, Appian puts it like this. The Rhodians of distinction of distinction were alarmed at the prospect of a conflict with Romans, but the common people were in high spirits because they recalled the former victories achieved over men of different character. So they launched 33 of their best ships, but while doing so, they nevertheless sent messengers to Mindus to urge Cassius not to despise Rhodes, which had always defended herself against those who underestimated her, and not to discharge the treaty which existed between the Rhodians and the Romans, which bound them together not to bear arms against each other. If Cassius complained of them for not rendering military assistance, they would be glad to hear from the Roman Senate, and if they were called upon, would lend such assistance. Now, as we all know, the Roman Senate isn't going to do anything like that because they're under the direct control of the triumvirate. So Cassius is pretty pissed about this. It doesn't matter how nicely or respectfully they say no, they're still saying no, and he has no choice. He needs to get as much food, soldiers, equipment, and ships as he can. So Cassius says to Rhodes, look, you've sided with the triumvirate already by allying yourself with Dolabella. And so the Rhodians remind him, look, we've taken on Mithridates the Great, and we've taken on Demetrius, and we've been invaded, and we're still here. We're still our own country. So if you want to try this, better men than you have tried. But again, Rhodes is not stupid. They're going to play the political card to the best of their ability. So they find Archelaus, who was the former teacher of Greek literature to Cassius, and they send him with a sincere petition. So Archelaus gets together with Cassius, and he's got his speech. O friend of the Greeks, do not destroy a Greek city. O friend of freedom, do not destroy Rhodes. Do not put to shame the glory of a Doric state hitherto unvanquished. Do not forget the famous histories you learned both at Rhodes and at Rome. At Rhodes, what the Rhodians accomplished against states and kings, especially against Demetrius and Mithridates the Great, who were deemed invincible, in behalf of that freedom for which you say you are also now contending. And at Rome, our services to you, among others, those that were rendered when we fought with you against Antiochus the Great, concerning which you have monuments inscribed in our honor. So they're saying, you can try all this, but better men than you have tried and they failed. But Cassius, his blood is up at this point. So Cassius replies, if you have not counseled the Rhodians not to wrong me, you have yourself done me wrong. If you have so counseled them and they have not followed your advice, I will avenge you. That I have suffered injury is plain enough. The first wrong done to me was when I asked for assistance and was slighted by my instructors and guardians. In the next place, they gave the preference to Dolabella, whom they have not brought up and educated, rather than to me. And what makes it worse, O freedom-loving Rhodians, is that Brutus and I are the most noble men of the Senate, whom you see here. We're fugitives from tyranny for endeavoring to liberate their country, while Dolabella was seeking to enslave it to others, whom you also favor while pretending to abstain from our civil wars. This would be a civil war if we were also aiming at supreme power, but it is plainly a war of the Republic against monarchy. And you, who appeal to me in behalf of your own freedom, have refused to aid the Republic. If you do not consider us as generals or even Romans, but as exiles or strangers or persons condemned, as the proscribers call us, O Rhodians, you have no treaties with us, but only with the Roman people. Being strangers and foreigners to treaties, we will fight you unless you obey our orders in everything. So again, Cassius is getting around their political argument by saying, fine, we understand you have a treaty with Rome, but right now we are the Rome. Even though we're not in Rome, we are the legitimate Republican power, and your treaty is with us, not with the dictators. But that's not going to fly with Rome. So obviously there's going to be a naval battle. So the Rhodians see that they're pleas for understanding have not worked, so they send out their ships. They send out 33 ships against Cassius's forces. Now, the Rhodians have fewer ships here, but they're lighter and faster, and they can maneuver around the Roman ships. So they send them out, and they're able to get in behind the Roman fleet and attack them from behind. And this is working pretty well at first. The Roman ships are larger, they're slower, they're more cumbersome, but they're better equipped. So when they do come into close contact, Cassius's ships are going to win most of the time. And in time, Cassius figures this out, and he uses his more numerous ships to negate the maneuverability of the Rhodian fleet. So eventually, some of the Rhodian ships are sunk, they're captured, the rest of them withdraw. And during this naval battle, Cassius is watching all this from a mountaintop. And he takes his ships back, he repairs them, and then he sends them to Larima, which is a fortified camp on the mainland right across from Rhodes. So Cassius is going to bring full pressure on Rhodes. He's going to attack their colony on the mainland, and he's going to use his ships to surround the island of Rhodes. And he's got about 80 ships. So Rhodes, their men on the mainland are trapped. Their island is surrounded. It's cut off. They don't have a chance, but they're going to fight anyway because they're proud. You know, everybody has their pride. So the Rhodians launch another attack, and they lose more ships, and it's not going to work. So Cassius is pressing in with his men. He's pressing in with his ships, and he's ready to take the walled cities of Rhodes. And finally, Rhodes gives up because they're in an untenable situation. And this is where, to me, Cassius shows his true colors and perhaps his desperation. When he goes into the city, he goes in with a spear in his hand, which is his way of saying, this is spear one territory. You defied me, so you have no rights. So he's sitting there and he goes into the city. But before this, he tells his men on pain of death, do not go around stealing, raping, killing. I'm here for a reason. I'm here to make a point, and I'm here to get things. I don't need you messing it up. So he's in the middle of the city and he calls 50 of the Rhodian citizens to himself. I'm not sure if they're the most richest or most important or whatever, but he brings 50 citizens together and he has them killed. And then he calls together 25 more citizens and he has them banished from Rhodes forever. And then he methodically, completely takes all the money, all the gold, all the silver, everything from the temples, everything from the public treasury, and anyone who is found hiding money or anything of worth is immediately killed. But he's not finished. Then he says to Rhodes and to Asia in general, all the different provinces, I want you to pay the tribute that you owe to Rome for the next 10 years, all in one go. And if you don't, I will find some other king to replace you. And that's exactly what he was willing to do. And so Rhodes has no chance. And Rhodes is just an example of one of many that had everything of value taken from them because Cassius has got to bring back all this to his Asian army, the army in Asian provinces to be ready to fight the triumvirs because he knows a major battle is coming. And again, these guys are no better than anyone else. They were willing to kill. They were willing to do whatever it takes for the sake of the Republic.
Nicely covered, Ray.
Thank you.
Yeah, they're the good guys. They're the liberators. Liberating people's money from them.
Right,
of course,
yeah.
When I think of Rhodes, I think of Randy Rhodes. That's just me.
Yeah.
Asking Aussie for answers, honestly. The last person I'm going to go to for answers is Aussie.
Hey, I have to tell you, this reminds me, you know, the second half of the week in Vegas, I was sick. Just It was all really a blur. The first half of the week was a pleasant. The first half of the week was a pleasant blur. The second half of the week was a not pleasant blur. But I came home and I dreamed that I was sitting next to you. I dream about you a lot. I was sitting next to you and I was singing. We were singing. And then I remembered that we actually recorded a show where you put up, I saw the words to the song on your screen and I was singing along with it. I was like, did that really fucking happen? Because I don't, that's when the sickness was coming on and I don't remember that show at all. So I had to go back. Shit, we did do that. That was cool.
Yeah. I also had my hand down the front of your pants, but I'm sure you've conveniently forgotten that part.
No comment. That's why I'm singing higher than normal.
So, yes, Cassius invades Rhodes. He also sold the populations of several communities of Judea into slavery.
Damn.
For his part, Brutus lays siege to Xanthus in Lycia, and many of the population commit suicide while that's going on.
Yeah.
You know, and we could go into a lot of detail about this stuff, but I really want to get through the Battle of Philippi. Rather than get sidetracked on the brutal shit that these guys were doing. Suffice to say, as you pointed out, Cassius and Brutus are brutal, brutal motherfuckers. Right. The way that they're conducting themselves, And again, the Rhodes, Judea, I mean, Judea was a friend of Rome, so was Rhodes. These guys, I mean, they're just being cunts, really. I mean, they're putting these guys in very difficult situations.
Yeah. I just have to throw out one part about the Xanthus in Lycia. So why Cassius is doing all these other things in Rhodes and Judea, Brutus is in Lycia, and he, you know, it's a huge battle. We don't have to go into it, but he literally shows he's got some stuff. He shows some metal. He exhorts his men. He does little mind tricks with them. He has a little contest, but they get closer and closer to the walls, and they're able to break into their city. And when it's clear to the Xanthians that they're going to lose, like you were saying, the men literally kill all of their family members. They jump upon the pyre that they had prepared, lit it, and then killed themselves. And so by the time the Romans come in and they've got the fires put out and they've got control of the city, there's like mostly slaves walking around. There's some women, and there's like only 150 men out of thousands. The rest had literally killed their families and killed themselves. And it's said that Brutus admired their love of liberty, that they were willing to kill themselves as opposed to be enslaved by them. And I'm calling bullshit on that. He loved their money more, because that's like Cassius, he took it all. So he can say what he can pay lip service or whatever, but you're still a fucking murderer, you know, and genocide. So again, these guys are no better than anyone else.
And the great irony is it's about this time that Brutus minted those famous coins with his own head on one side, something that was, as we know, first done by Julius Caesar, putting his own head on a coin. But on the other side, it's the knives that they used to stab Caesar and the Liberty cap that I think we talked about in the assassination episode of Caesar. So, you know, he's like, yes, liberty is so important to me while I'm, you know, committing acts of genocide in these places, wiping people out and taking their money.
Yeah, just because you put the cap of liberty on the backside of a coin and put your face on one side, that doesn't cancel out all the shit you just did to get that silver. So, yeah, again, it's lip service.
But again, you think about the difficult situation these people in Lycia or Rhodes or Judea are in. You know, they want to be friendly with Rome. They had peace treaties. They had been, you know, sort of occupied, but they had their own rulers, particularly in Judea. They didn't ask for this. There's a civil war in Rome that they're getting sucked into. If you pick either side and you end up on the wrong side, you're screwed. They've just been through one civil war that Rome had with Caesar and Pompey, where they had to sort of, you know, throw their weight into one side or the other. That's right. They've had demands for money and soldiers the other. That was only a couple of years ago. Now they're going through it again. It just never ends for these people.
Yeah. And if I can just bring up two quick points. When you have a civil war, you have a complete breakdown in order and stability. So while Cassius is going all over the place, his next plan is to go to Cleopatra of Egypt, because he knows, you know, yeah, she's been supporting, and supporting the Romans, and he hears that she is going to send the triumvirates some naval support. So he's going to go there, punish her, take everything she's got. But by that time, he hears that Octavian and Mark Antony are crossing the Adriatic, so he doesn't have time. But he was going to go to Egypt. I mean, just think of how, you know, maybe different history would have been if he had killed her or whatever. But not only that, but there are some Parthian mounted bowmen who are with Cassius. And he's like, there's not enough of you to make a difference. Here's some gifts. I want you to go back to the Parthian king and ask for more help. Now, by the time the Parthians get back, the war is over. So they literally turn around, sack Syria and the surrounding areas, and then they go home. So they literally went in and took more, you know, robbed the land that's been robbed 3 or 4 times in the last decade or whatever. So again, it's just a complete breakdown in order, and it's pretty much, you know, bandits running all over the place, taking whatever they got, because the majesty and the power of Rome is not there to keep everybody in line like they had been doing for, you know, hundreds of years.
Sucks to be a peasant in the outskirts, really, doesn't it?
It never sucks. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're getting towards the end of 42 BCE, the summer. The assassins do a reverse Alexander. They move their armies across the Hellespont and into Macedonia.
Right. We're strong enough now. Let's go. Let's do this. It's game time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Antony and Octavian had sent 8 legions, about 36,000 troops, into Macedonia in advance of the main body coming over. They sort of had the classic old problem that we've seen time and time again. They didn't have enough ships to get everyone across in one hit.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So they send their 8 legions over. And, you know, that's going to kind of keep an eye, keep the conspirators honest. And they're going to get a little closer. So the men of Mark Antony and Caesar, they're going to back up a little bit, and they're going to go back up a little bit to Amphipolis. And so they're going to wait. And like you said, they don't have enough ships. So the triumvirs are going to bring half of their men over. So they send some more men, and they're going to bring another half over. But right away, they're having trouble with the enemy, who's got a hell of a lot more ships than they are. And they have to worry about Sextus Pompey, who's also, pirating in the area. So they're actually going to have trouble leaving the port of Brundisium just to get across the Adriatic.
Yeah.
That's how fucked up this is for them.
Yeah. Outmaneuvered. Now, the advance force, as you say, retreats to Amphipolis, which, of course, we know is the home of the famous tomb of Philip II of Macedon.
Woo-hoo!
Do you think maybe they visited that? They took a little detour and went to visit Big Philly Mac?
If time permit, if not on their way there, then maybe on their way back. But, I mean, how do you not go see that? You know, it's like Vegas back then. How do you not go see that if you're in the area?
Yeah. Now, the assassins follow them and take up position in front of the city of Philippi, named, of course, after Big Philly Mac.
Yeah.
Alex's dad. Now, the triumvirates, as you say, their main force is struggling to get out of Brundisium. Octavian has some naval skirmishes with Sexy P, a.k.a. Sextus Pompey.
Right.
Sexy P is what he had on his, you know, he had a big
it was on the back of his back. Yeah.
Big golden diamond ring that took up the 4 fingers on his right hand and just had Sexy P written on it. That's how they refer to him. By now, Sextus Pompey, Pompey the Great's surviving son, had won possession of Sicily, and he's got a pretty decent navy. So they're skirmishing with him. They're even struggling just to get out of Italy.
Right.
Antony had to fight off raids on the port of Brundisium, as you mentioned, before he could get out of there. And then they only just managed to get part of their forces across the Adriatic before Ahenobarbus, son of old Redbeard himself,
right,
one of Julius Caesar's great enemies who died during the Civil War, but this is his son, he manages to close off the sea route for some time. So they've still got only part of their troops, this massive army that they've pulled together over to Macedonia, and then the sea lanes get blocked.
Yeah, so not to go too far forwards, but by the time there is going to be a battle, the conspirators do have more men. We can argue about numbers, but they have more men. They certainly have more cavalry. So Mark Antony and Octavian, the sickly one, they are going to be on the defensive. They're going to be the weaker of the forces that are coming up. But they're going to have to do something, because once they're trapped, once the sea lanes are closed to them, they've only got so many supplies. And God, good God, how many times did Julius Caesar have to deal with that? They can't wait around forever. The conspirators have a ton of supplies, and they've got a secure line to go back and get more supplies, so that once the triumvirs come across, they can't just sit around forever. They're going to run out of food. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. So they land at Apollonia, which, mm-hmm. of course, was where, you know, just a little over 2 years ago, Octavian was sitting around.
Getting ready for Julius to show up at any day. But instead, a letter comes to him 2 years ago. Oh, you, guess what? He's dead, and, you know, your life's about to change.
Yeah. On the sea voyage over, though, Octavian falls ill yet again.
Yeah.
We don't really know what was wrong with him. But once he lands, he's not able to travel any further. You go on without me, Antony. I'll catch up. Shit. Yeah. He basically pulled a Ray in Vegas. It was like, oh, I can't handle it anymore. I'm not feeling well.
For me. Oh, that's something else. It's like literally he cannot.
I smoked half a cigar and now I'm not feeling well.
He literally is so weak he can't ride a horse. He has to be prostrate. And I would love to know what was going on. Was it like a migraine? Was it his stomach? I mean, was it we just don't know. But whatever it was, it incapacitated him, and it seemed to be real. It seemed to be legit, and he could not even mount a horse. So, well, sorry, that came out. But Mark Antony's like, fuck this, I got to go, because those eight legions could easily be wiped out by the shit ton of men the other guys have got. So I got to go there with my men to support them, because there's no sense in letting eight legions be wiped out. That's just bad generalship.
Mm. Yeah, so he Antony presses on, leaves Octavian behind.
See you, kid.
Yeah, that's right. And he first goes to reinforce the troops that are in Amphipolis, and he finally ends up camping facing the assassins at Philippi.
Yeah.
And they've got him fairly well outnumbered. I think they have probably a third more.
They could
than he does at this stage.
Yeah, you can be a clumsy general. If you've got a third more men, you can launch your attack, lose a shit ton of men, and still win the war. And hell, if they die, you don't have to pay them. So, but for whatever reason, and I couldn't figure this out, especially Cassius, because Cassius seems to be the hothead or whatever. I don't know. He seems to be the one who really wants to do this. I would think that he would attack right away, send out some men, kind of find out that, you know, the other half of the army is still at Apollonia. But he doesn't do anything. And they just kind of skirmish. They line up. They stare at each other. There's some skirmishing, but not much going on for about 10 days. Nothing happens. Nothing serious happens, which is very fortunate for Mark Antony.
And fortunate for Octavian. Because whatever was wrong with him took him 10 days to recover. Mm-hmm. Who knows? Maybe it was food poisoning. Maybe it was, I don't know, man.
But he gets sick again. I wonder if it was the same sickness. Or has he just got a weak constitution? We just do not know.
Yeah. Anyway, after about 10 days, Octavian finally catches up. It's nearly his 21st birthday.
Yay!
He's actually still sick, though. So he's being carried in a litter all of the way instead of riding his horse.
That's manly.
Anyway, he gets there. The triumvirs have about 19 legions with them. The rest of their legions have mostly managed, because I think they had 20, so they must have nearly all of their legions.
Right.
Now, this is as many as JC and Pompey had combined at the Battle of Pharsalus in 48.
That's staggering. That is absolutely staggering. How do you control, organize? You can't.
Yeah. Yeah. The assassins have 17 legions, mm-hmm. so the triumvirs outnumber them by, you know, if they're at full strength, these legions, sort of 9,000, 8,000 or 9,000 guys in terms of infantry. But The assassins had a cavalry advantage, 20,000 cavalry versus 13,000 for the triumvirs.
Yeah. And so here's I just want to say real quick, here's the other part, and we don't have to really go into this, but it's interesting, and it makes sense to me. Caesar does not relinquish command. He doesn't pick a deputy, you know, because there's no way he's going to give all his men to Mark Antony, one, because that would just be giving him all the power, and two, they don't care about Mark Antony because he's not paying them. And so, but you would think he would pick a deputy, okay, until I'm on my feet, at least somebody's running my men, but he refuses to do that, and I can kind of see why. But again, it's just a huge negative for someone who's already inexperienced at generalship.
Yeah. Now, we're talking all up now, there's about 200,000 soldiers at the Battle of Philippi. Mm-hmm. Although, maybe slightly less. It's possible that all the legions weren't at full strength, but either way. Yeah,
ton of men. Yeah, more than ever before.
Yeah, a massive number of men. Now, the cavalry numbers might be inflated. I mean, it was difficult to transport horses over the sea, not to mention bring enough food and fodder for them.
Right.
But as you pointed out, the assassins had plenty of access to food and horses on the, you know, the eastern side. So even if they weren't at full capacity, though, this is a huge force, probably fairly few veterans amongst them. The vast majority would have been new recruits or at least men with very little prior battle experience, and this is including the commanders. I mean, apart from the recent things they'd done in Rhodes and Judea, Brutus and Cassius, as I mentioned before, had very little direct experience in managing large campaigns. Cassius had served as Crassus' quaestor in 53 BCE, but that was 20 years ago.
20 years ago, he led a retreat. That's not exactly military experience.
He and Brutus had both served in the Macedonian campaign under Pompey back in 48, but neither of them had any senior command.
Yeah, so even their officers don't have any experience. And then there's, excuse me for saying this, Julius Caesar over there going, "I'm almost 21." Yeah, and he's on his back. I mean, what the hell? I guess I don't know if this is a good thing or a bad thing. I think it's just the way it worked out. But opposing Caesar's men are Brutus's men, and opposing Mark Antony, we're going to get into all this probably on the next episode, but opposing Mark Antony is Cassius's men. So I guess that was best for the triumvirs to have the strong against the strong, weak against the weak. But again, there's no one really guarding the triumvirate's left flank because Caesar is on his back.
That's right. And Antony himself, he had a little more experience, but he had never been the guy in charge.
Yeah.
I mean, apart from the recent skirmishes at Mutina and places like that where it didn't end too well for him, when he was, when he was under Julius Caesar, the real Julius Caesar, you know, he'd had small bits of command. You know, you go take the right wing, etc. But it was really Caesar that was calling the play.
Yeah. And so, now here's – yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, sorry. So on both sides here, you've got the largest armies – ever deployed by Rome in the battlefield under the command of guys without even a fraction of the experience of either Caesar or Pompey.
Right.
None of them have any idea really how to command an army of this size. I mean, neither Caesar nor Pompey had ever led so many legions into battle. This is a war that's going to be fought between large and clumsy armies with second-rate commanders. And as you pointed out before, on each side, it's not really one army. Brutus has his army. Cassius has his army. They're not one united force. They're two forces paid by two guys taking orders from two separate guys, not integrated into a single command. It's even worse on the triumvir side because you've got, you know, half of them loyal to Antony, half of them loyal supposedly to Octavian, but Octavian's lying sick and, as you say, hadn't appointed somebody to command in his place. This is going to be a clusterfuck.
Yeah, so like you said just a second ago, whatever happens, it's going to be ugly, it's going to be clumsy, which is bad enough, but whoever wins the entire Western world.
And that, I think, Ray, is where we should leave episode 13, on the eve of the Battle of Philippi, the battle for control, as you say, of the Western world, the battle for the control of history. Is it going to be Caesar's assassins or Caesar's successors that come out on top? You'll have to tune in next time to find out, folks. I'm sure you have no idea how this all ends up. I have no idea.
I can't wait.
I don't know.
I'll be here next week.
If the snow doesn't... If you don't go any more sled rides, you'll be here next week.
I'm retired.
Thanks, Ray. Thanks, everybody. Don't forget, video, Life of Caesar.
Check out
/Vegas. Yeah. It was a good, fun conversation. We got a standing ovation from the guys in the room at the end of
it. That's true.
They all loved it. So I think you'll love it too.
My favorite part was when you were trying to corral Sir J. David Markham for an hour and 10 minutes.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm getting paid for this, right?
So how much money am I getting for this?
Here's two drinks that cost a shit ton of money. Here's your pay.
Yeah, $50 a shot of scotch.
He knows what he likes. I give him that.
Yeah, particularly when I'm paying.
I got a shirt. Anyway.
Yeah. See ya.
See ya.